This week on The Best of Flashpoints, Ruckus Society and Earth First co-founder Mike Rozelle talks about the TVA coal ash disaster in Tennessee and the catastrophic ecological and cultural price of mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. And Greg Palast talks about Obama's new boondoggle plan to try to stop millions of family home foreclosures by throwing even more money at the same predatory mortgage bankers that caused the crisis in the first place. I'm Amanda Bellerby with Dennis Bernstein. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Amanda Bellerby. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Just over a month ago, in late December, two beautiful waterways, the Clinch and the Emory Rivers, both adjacent to the Tennessee Valley Authority's massive Kingston coal plant, were poisoned when an earthen dam next to the plant burst, unleashing a toxic slurry of coal ash. More than a billion gallons buried 400 acres of land up to 9 feet deep in thick black muck oozing with arsenic, cadmium, lead, chromium, and mercury, all known to cause cancer and birth defects. It was the largest industrial accident in American history, more than 100 times larger than the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. To add insult to calamity, less than 3 weeks later, on January 9th, another TVA sludge dam burst, sending another 10,000 gallons, spewing into Widows Creek, this time in Alabama. The larger Tennessee River is downstream from both of these sites. Ominously, there are no federal regulations classifying coal ash as hazardous waste, and King Coal wants to keep it that way. Joining me by phone to help us understand the scope of these and other coal crimes is Mike Rozelle. He was once director of Greenpeace USA and is well known in environmental circles as a brilliant campaigner and strategist. He was also a member of the Youth International Party, or Yippies, and co-founded the Rainforest Action Network, the Ruckus Society, and Earth First. And he's pretty famous for direct actions with a flair for political spectacle, like when he scaled Mount Rushmore and hung a giant gas mask on George Washington's stony face to protest acid rain. Mike has trained 1,000 or 2 people in various forms of nonviolent civil disobedience. He's currently a columnist at lowbagger.org and joins us by phone from the Coal River Valley in West Virginia, where he and others are preparing to take on Massey Energy, also known as King Coal, in the heart of Appalachia. Mike Rozelle, welcome back to Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Okay, let's start with the TVA spill in December in Tennessee. You were there soon after that for a couple of weeks, and from what I understand, that part of the Clinch and the Emory River valleys are really devastated. So can you start by just describing the mess and what confronted you when you got there on the ground?
Well, my first visit was directly after the spill, and we had heard about it up here in the Coal River Valley in West Virginia, less than a mile from us, is another large impoundment of coal sludge. The folks that are up here that we work with have been monitoring this situation for a long time and have been fearing something exactly like this would happen somewhere and maybe even here. There was a high security perimeter set up around the spill that we were able to get through, fortunately, with the help of a local person. And it is a really devastating sight. I haven't seen anything like this in my 35-year career. It's a very different kind of a spill than the one that was described in the paper. That was the first thing that I noticed. First of all, it was described as a pond, and it was described as a breach of a dam, and it was described as a spill. And all those things are incorrect. What happened was the collapse of a pile. And this pile was fly ash that came out of the coal-powered generator, which has been burning coal there for 50 years. But this particular kind of ash comes out of the smokestack, and it's the result of, I know you mentioned Mount Rushmore action that we did a few years ago, many years ago actually, more than I'd like to say. That was to get the sulfur dioxide out of these emissions, and the equipment that was installed was pretty effective. It got about 90%, which is not enough to consider the emissions safe, but the stuff that does come out comes out in this ash. Instead of dumping a lot of these pollutants into the air, we're now collecting them and storing them near a river. The original configuration was a large field, you know, with a small dike in front of it, but over the years they kept putting layer upon layer of additional ash on it, and it resembled a stepped pyramid. The material that was used for the dike was the same material that was in the pile.
So how high was this pile, Mike?
It was 50 feet high.
Wow. And how high was the so-called dike?
10, 15 feet at the most. And like I said, it wasn't a true dike. I mean, it wasn't made of engineered material. It was just the waste material itself. And it was covered with a very thin layer of clay. And this clay had some grasses, and at the base they'd planted some fast-growing exotic pine trees to kind of make it, you know, blend in with the wildlife refuge that it was directly adjacent to. So, you know, when you talk about a dam, you're usually talking about something that has a certain amount of strength. This was not a dam. It was never meant to contain the collapse of the pile. The pile became somehow supersaturated with water and was unstable, so even if there was a much stronger dam, it may have been blown out, too, by this pile, because we're talking about a lot of material.
Now, the company said that the reason it got so sodden was because of all the rain and the freezing and so on. What is your response to that?
Well, there was rain and freezing, and of course, anybody that lives near one of these dams always gets nervous when this happens, because there's been a history of blowouts during weather events, but this wasn't worse than a normal winter storm. To blame it on the weather is really is inappropriate. This was a failure in the design of the whole system, because they just kept putting stuff on top of stuff on top of stuff. I mean, if you have a compost pile, you know, it takes a lot of rain to soak it all the way to the bottom. One storm couldn't have done that. I suspect that water was getting into the pile through underground means, you know, springs, and something that they weren't aware of. And I would suspect they should be checking the moisture content. They weren't.
Was it lined?
No, it was not lined, and the stuff was put on there wet, and right, that allowed the liquids to drain out through the bottom into the river, but they always claimed that this was inert.
Talk a little bit about what it looked like on the ground. What was it like to walk up to it and look out over it?
Well, I was at one of the residents' house, a fellow named Sandy, and he was right directly across from the dam. The dam had traveled all the way across the slough. Behind the dam was this big avalanche of material from the pile collapsing. So the dam was almost intact.
Pushed forward, you mean?
Yeah, it was pushed forward, and it was in big chunks that people called ashbergs. And then behind it was 20 feet deep in ash. The first couple of days, anyway, the dam was relatively intact. And then after a few more days of rain, it quickly melted away. This kind of demonstrated how flimsy a structure this dam was.
Can you talk about what's actually in this coal ash?
Well, there's all kinds of heavy metals in it. When coal is burned, there are a lot of heavy metals in coal that get concentrated in the ash if they don't go up the stack. All the contaminants that the Clean Air Act mandated them taking out of the air was going into this ash. I think yearly there's 95 million tons of coal ash produced.
Nationally?
Yep.
95 million tons.
Mm-hmm.
Boggles the mind.
That's, you know, the average municipality that burns coal is producing three times more coal ash than they are household and municipal waste. So if you think of a landfill that an average city has, the coal they burn would produce three times that amount of waste. It contains some of the most toxic heavy metals that we know of. And the thing is, this has been called bigger than the Exxon Valdez just because of the sheer amount of these chemicals. And, you know, it's not like they were all dumped in the Rotter all at once. This is like a big tea bag, and it will be leaching these chemicals for a long time. The recent tests have shown already that the water quality is exceeding the EPA limits. But once this thing gets really cooking and more water is drained through it, this is something that's going to keep emitting a tremendous amount of heavy metals and into the Clinch and Tennessee rivers, which hook up with the eventually with the Mississippi and is a source of drinking water for millions and millions of people.
What impacts can you tell us about on water, fish, and animals? Because we haven't heard anything in the major media about any impact on critters other than human beings.
Well, I mean, the first impact was the collapse of the pile, pushed all the water and all the silt on the bottom of the river and everything all the way up to the bank of the other river, which is kind of a hill. All of the wildlife that was in that 400-acre area, it was a riparian forest with the river slough and creeks going into it, so all the types of animals you expect to find.
Lots of birds and raccoons and deer.
Yeah, beavers and muskrats and deer and all sorts of reptiles. We saw dead turtles. All that wildlife was obliterated, just completely obliterated. Nothing could have survived, not even a snail. So it was gone. And then there was the other wildlife populations that probably used the area occasionally, and then some of them got back into the area. We've heard stories of very sick and dying animals and that sort of thing. But, I mean, in terms of wildlife habitat, this place has been set back at least 50 years and a lot more. There's nothing there. It's 20 foot deep and hazardous waste, and right now the main thing is that they're trying to get the water to run around it rather than run through it. They're not doing a very good job of that.
What about the drinking water for the local people?
Well, in the beginning, TVA said everybody boil their water, and that didn't make any sense at all, since it's usually for some kind of a bacterial contamination. It doesn't help get rid of heavy metals at all. If anything, it concentrates them. This is an incredible amount of material, and it's going to be releasing over a long period of time. So it's not the big surge like the Exxon Valdez, where a lot of oil was dispersed over a large area immediately. This stuff will be leaching for as long as it's there.
Talk about TVA a little bit. Who are they, and how is it that all this dangerous coal crud is lying around unregulated and kept behind these earthen dikes? How do they get away with this?
Well, I mean, the secret has been that they have not been treating this, even with the kind of environmental regulations that go for household garbage. They refer to this as material. They describe it as inert.
Even though it is the product of meeting the standards of the Clean Air Act.
Right.
nice.
But
nice
they have been able to exempt these kind of ashes from being considered hazardous waste, and that's the only thing that allows these things to be operated in the way that they're operated. I mean, all of these piles are going to fail. It's just a matter of when. And it was much cheaper for them to do it this way. We're going to see a lot more of this unless these things are treated, you know, as hazardous material, which require that it be lined, to be dry, and that nothing be allowed to escape. You know, it's, even so, this is way too much material to ever deal with safely.
How many of these things are there waiting to fail around the country?
There's hundreds of them. 721 power plants. Each one of them are storing waste somewhere, but 156 coal-fired power plants store ash in surface ponds similar to the one that collapsed in Tennessee. They're all near water. They're all susceptible to weather events or failures in engineering, and eventually, they're going to move downriver. They're going to contaminate the water. The only solution to this is to quit making this stuff.
In the first 6 years of the Bush administration, there were proposals for 150 new coal plants, but a bunch of them have been scrapped. So what's your conclusion there? What's happening?
The problem we're having is not with the proposed new coal plants. Not only were over 60 of them canceled last year, it looks like now with the financial crisis that many of the ones that are in the pipeline there's simply not going to be financing for. And then the uncertainty over pricing and energy taxes, carbon taxes, that sort of thing, has made money very scarce. But like if you look at this TVA plant in Kingston, it's 50 years old. It's one of the 100th most polluting facility in North America. These plants are behemoths. They consume a lot of coal and put out a lot of carbon dioxide. They would be the best targets for us to start reducing our CO2 emissions. It's just unimaginable now that in days like this, with what we know about the climate, that we're still operating these antique plants with this inferior technology that's just killing people locally and threatening people globally with climate change.
So regulation of this stuff being classified as hazardous waste, it's not enough to be asking for, is it?
Well, we need to demand that they do that just to protect our water and the communities that live near this, absolutely. But we have to stop mining and burning coal because it's a very, very dirty process. And all along the way in this process, there are environmental costs that just totally outweigh any benefit that we get from receiving the cheaper electricity. We have many other ways to make electricity than coal.
Okay, let's talk about where you are now, the Coal River Valley, West Virginia.
Well, this is often called the coal fields by the industry, and it's been a sacrifice area in the Appalachian Mountains. And this has been a coal mining region for over 100 years. Some of these areas have been mining coal for 200 years, but the mountaintop removal process is a relatively recent innovation made possible by the bigger machines that they have.
Big drag lines, right?
There are drag lines, bulldozers, and dump trucks much larger than anything that most people have ever seen. In the mining of the coal, there is a lot of sorting and cleansing and separating and processing that produces an equal amount of waste as it does when they burn it. And then there's also the overburden that they take off to exposed seams, which is dumped in the stream valleys. Right where I'm standing right now, there are three major mountaintop removal operations. This material is put in these high dams, and the Chumet Dam is almost 400 feet high. That's like half as high as Hoover Dam. Very steep, rugged, knife-edged Appalachian Canyon has a 385-foot high dam, and if this fails, which it certainly will at some point, there's twice as much toxic material behind this as there was in the Tennessee spill. And because of the grade of the river and the towns downstream would cause much more damage than just spilling out across a floodplain. There's also an elementary school right below the dam. And if it happened during school hours, everyone in that school would be killed.
While coal camps echoed with the mournful sounds of impoverished voices from deep in the ground. Under this company town is what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Amanda Bellerby. I'm speaking with Earth First co-founder and noted rabble-rouser Mike Rozelle. So, Mike, there's 2.8 billion gallons of coal waste behind this dam.
Yeah.
The community is below this.
The elementary school, Marsh Fork Elementary, is right on the Coal River. And then just below that is the town of Whitesville. So this would continue to fill the canyons and surge down, you know, much like an avalanche would down a canyon, and would result in a much higher loss of life, no matter what time of day it happened at.
Can you share some stories from that community, just about what it's like to be that close to mountaintop removal, the blasting and the dust, and just give us an idea what it's like to be near that stuff as it happens?
Well, it's very difficult to be opposed to the coal industry and live in this part of the country. It has been the economic backbone for, you know, almost two centuries Yet many people here have come to the conclusion that this latest phase of mountaintop removal has just been too much. At 4:20 every day, the blasting happens, and they spend the next 24 hours clearing off the rubble. And exactly why they have chosen that time, I don't know. Some speculation is that the children are out of school at Marsh Fork, and they themselves fear that that would be the most likely time that the dam would fail.
From the sheer force of the explosions, do you mean?
Well, these are not very stable structures, and so shaking them, you can imagine pudding or something. It seems solid, but if you shake it, it will just collapse. There's really nothing holding it back.
So how does it feel when one of these things goes off? Can you feel it in your home?
Well, it rattles the windows all up and down the river. Your people here will say, "Damn Massey," when they hear that. There is a lot of resentment over this. Many of the jobs on these types of mine sites are held by people from out of town. There are many locals that do work there. Sometimes this tears families apart. There's a lot of tension over this. People are noticing the lack of hunting and places to get firewood as the mountains are literally being removed. A friend of mine came over today, and a couple of days ago, one of the miners at the MTR site was killed. He'd only been on the job for 6 or 7 days. Massey has refused to compensate him or pay his funeral costs or anything because he hadn't been working there for very long. And we just heard that a coal miner that lives here, a friend of ours, just quit working for Massey over that. So they are used to dealing with coal companies around here, and they've seen some, I suppose, some good ones and some bad ones, but nothing has engendered the animosity and anger that Massey has from the very beginning. Their policy has been to depopulate this area, to extract the coal, and to leave. And it's happening at a scale that is literally just mind-boggling. Where I'm at right now, literally the sun comes up a little earlier every morning because of the fact that Coal River Mountain is being slowly shaved down.
So how is it organizing there with environmentalists coming in from out of town?
The local groups here had reached out to environmental groups across the country, educated people, but the frustrating part, I think, for them is that things still have not changed. And waste instead of fill, so that no more creeks are buried and no more mountaintops are blown up. But, you know, there has been no action taken on that. And even if he was to oppose any new mountaintop removal permits, we're still dealing with the ones that are going on now. So, you know, I think what folks here really want to do is to find any way possible to pressure this administration to immediately end the practice of mountaintop removal and to begin to dismantle all the coal-fired power plants and end coal mining in this area forever. People that I talk to, even though they're rural, even though their families' histories go back many generations, you know, they're concerned about climate change, they're concerned about air pollution, they're concerned about the impacts that coal being mined up here are having all the way down in Knoxville, in the river bottom. And they see the big picture, and they know that something has to be done soon, or their home will be destroyed, but also that their planet will be destroyed. So I feel very honored and privileged to be amongst such really committed, dedicated people. And the feeling here is that they're not going to stop until they succeed. This region has a history of opposition. You know, this is where the union movement was born with United Mine Workers. And they've been through strikes together. And so it's a very strong community. West Virginians, by and large, are in favor of moving away from coal into alternative energy. But in these counties where the coal is mined, the companies have an iron grip on the political process, and they elect the judges, and they have been used to getting their way. And so until that changes, then nothing will be different here. But I think the hope for these groups is that they can somehow arouse the conscience of the nation, and you know, to bring some additional pressure to bear from from outside. When the economy is at stake, generally a majority of the voters, just enough, will keep these people in power. Some of these groups have been around for decades. Judy Bonds, who we work with at Coal River Mountain Watch, was a Goldman Award winner. So these are some very good, talented, staunch organizers, and you know, they spend their time going all over the country. And if we really want to address climate change, it seems to me that we've got to deal with this coal issue. This is the worst part of coal mining, and it exposes the myth that coal could ever be clean. Scrubbing the carbon out of it doesn't make it clean. Stacking the ash piles up more neatly doesn't make it clean. What makes it dirty is the extraction and processing and trashing of the Appalachian Mountains.
So I guess I need to ask the obligatory, what do you expect from the Obama administration question, because he sure talked about this imaginary thing called clean coal an awful lot on the campaign trail.
Well, I never thought he was serious about clean coal. I think they understand that it cannot be clean, but during his election, he could not afford to lose votes in states that the coal industry is very strong in. But I do believe he said that he was going to pay attention to the science. And he did say that saving the environment is not less important than fixing the economy. So if he sticks to those principles, then you know, certainly he's going to be a vast improvement over the last administration. But I think it's up to us, rather than wait for Obama to do the right thing, is to continue to exert as much pressure now as we ever have, and to make sure that he doesn't do the wrong thing. And the wrong thing would be to put any of this stimulus money into clean coal technology, and instead to focus all of it on ridding us of our addiction to coal, which is rapidly killing us, not slowly killing us.
You've got some actions planned coming up.
We are planning on engaging in civil disobedience a week from tomorrow at the base of the Shoemate Dam. This is something that we don't want Massey to know ahead of time about, because they have a history of mobilizing the women for coal, who can easily outnumber the locals here, and they tend to get very aggressive and violent. And for this particular action, we wanted to preserve some dignity, and we want to maintain the element of surprise. But I expect that you know, that a week from tomorrow there will be a very important demonstration here, where many members of the community come out for the first time and not only oppose the destruction of Coal River Mountain, the Grandfather Mountain, the biggest mountain around here, the mountain from which you can see almost the rest of the state from, but are willing to put their bodies on the line and be arrested to demonstrate that.
What is the most important thing for you going forward from here?
Well, the most important thing for me is that people do not get too taken up in this new presidency. This is not a time to sit back and wait for the government to do those things that need to be done. This is a time for citizens to stand up and demand them. And I'm afraid that if people are too hopeful, that we will miss an opportunity. The Obama administration is going to get a lot of pressure from the coal industry and from the people who would like to think that there is such thing as cheap electricity. And it's incumbent for us to really, really redouble our efforts and make this point now, and to take coal off the table. And we have other fossil fuels also to deal with, but certainly this is the worst one. So the thing that really worries me the most is that, you know, I'm old enough to have been around when Jimmy Carter was elected and when Bill Clinton elected, and they promised to do things for us, for the environment, to address these issues, and they did not. They put people on their cabinets and in their administration, and they co-opted the environmental movement by asking them to just step back and allow them to take care of this. So that's my biggest fear. So I have a great deal of respect for the new president. I know he wants to do the right thing, but he is going to need pressure from the environmental movement right now like he's never seen before, and we have to demand clean energy.
And where can people get more information?
Lobagger.org.
Lobagger.org, that's your blog. And how about on the mountaintop removal and Coal River Valley?
My favorite place to get information on this issue is the I Love Mountains website, ilovemountains.org.
Great. Well, thanks for all the great information, Mike. We really appreciate you joining us on Flashpoints.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate talking to you.
Our parents' memories of World War II. Minds were drowned, the clock was the American thing to do. Families gathered round their radios to hear FDR say we'd make it somehow in our town.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the economic stimulus bailout and the plan to help millions of homeowners stay off the foreclosure route and keep their houses. Joining us to talk about this is Greg Palast. He's the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. He is a reporter for the BBC. You can check out his great work at gregpalast.com. Greg, welcome back. Well, Obama was in Phoenix yesterday, $75 billion plan to help millions of Americans stay in their houses. Give us your analysis, your take. What was that?
That was my, as I'm a trained economist, and that's our the response of those who actually know something about finance and economics. The truth is that it's a raspberry. It's better than nothing, I suppose. And already, I was listening to right wing radio. They're already talking about, well, what's next? They're going to let them keep their welfare Cadillacs. You know, it's these people's own fault. Of course, it's mostly their listeners. It's not close to enough. It's not even a question of enough, but how they're going about this. The President of the United States is going to the Mortgage Bankers of America, the snakes, sharks, predators, reptiles, creeps, and criminals in some cases, according to experts in the area, who have ripped off people buying a home. And instead of saying, here's the terms that you guys, that are going to keep you guys in business, he's begging these guys to provide help. So let me make this very specific. I was just in the 8 Mile neighborhood of Detroit, you know, Eminem's hometown there, speaking with Robert Pratt. He's a guy who has 5 kids. He had 6, but one was shot in his backyard by a stray bullet. He is facing foreclosure by Countrywide Financial. Countrywide Financial is a unit of Bank of America, which is so far, and they're going to get more, so far received $50 billion, Bank of America, from the U.S. government. And the reason they need $50 billion is that their mortgage unit, Countrywide Financial, is not only going broke, but is way below broke, and their Merrill Lynch unit decided to gamble on Countrywide Financial mortgages and went double broke. They were given $25 billion, and literally within 90 days of receiving the government money, they lost $15 billion on it in speculation. Okay, so now Obama's going back to these people that we just gave $50 billion to, who lost $15 billion of it literally gambling on the market, and now begging them to refinance mortgages. Now, Robert Pratt has a mortgage on which he's paying $1,000 a month. On, by the way, a home that's worth about $40,000. It's ridiculous. The mortgage should be $400 a month. He's paying $1,000 a month. He is a UAW member. He works 7 days a week. It's not like he's slacking here. But what happened was there's what's called an interest explosion clause in his Countrywide Financial Bank of America mortgage. What an explosion clause is it doubles your interest after a couple years. It's hidden in there, and you don't have a choice. People say, well, why did they sign these deals? It's not like you have a choice. And when anyone asks the question, why is my interest rate going to go up after a couple of years? The mortgage answer is, don't worry, we'll refinance it. Well, Pratt was just hit with an increase, pure interest, to $1,500 a month, which is, you know, more than half his take-home pay. There's no way with five kids he can afford this. In fact, he's almost insane to afford it because the mortgage is like $100,000 on a $40,000 home. So it's really simple. What Obama needs to do is say, you're not getting the billions and billions and billions, Bank of America, unless you say that we will stop kicking up interest rates, unless you say that there will be no more foreclosures. That's why we're giving you the money. And it's not just a question of that's the fair thing to do with our money. It's also a question that if we don't stop the foreclosures, everyone, at the core of the heart of the worldwide meltdown is the shenanigans in the U.S. mortgage market, and we've got to stop the foreclosures. It's bringing down everyone's home value. Phoenix is on its knees because with all those foreclosures, no one can sell anything. So instead of begging the banks and trying to induce them to refinance mortgages, they have to make that a condition of the $2 trillion in TARP and other money that comes out. They have to make it a condition. Right now, what Obama's offering is $1,000 to every bank which refinances a mortgage. In other words, the U.S. taxpayer is going to give Bank of America another $1,000 per mortgage it refinances on their crappy predatory mortgages. Forget the fact that we already gave them $50 billion. That's the problem. So, And we're already being told that the bankers aren't even going to accept this money, that Obama's plan is dead on arrival. No, because these banks are saying, we're not going to we want more than $1,000. Why should we take $1,000? We can just take these people's homes.
Wow. We're speaking with Greg Palast. We're talking about Obama's visit to Phoenix yesterday, $75 billion plan, he says, to bail out some 9 million. He calls them responsible homeowners. Now, I want to talk about that responsible thing. As you know, Greg, we did a lot of reporting on a woman by the name of Penny Pritzker, and she is still a major economic advisor to Obama. And she is the woman who structured the kinds of operations, subprime operations, and the sale to Wall Street that bamboozled, that undermined, that tricked millions of people who were trying to buy houses who were in trouble now.
Right.
And they keep, as you say, on right-wing radio, you know, they're the ones, supposedly the welfare queens driving Cadillacs. But talk a little bit about how so many people were tricked by people like Penny Pritzker, who still remains an advisor to Obama. Maybe she's the one giving him the advice to do this.
Well, let's look at it this way. Obama wouldn't be president without Penny Pritzker. She's the one who picked out Obama for us. She took this state senator from Hyde Park. Penny Pritzker is just about the richest, one of the richest women in the planet. She's personally worth over $2 billion and lives in Obama's district on the north shore of Lake Michigan in Chicago. And she's the one who said, let's take this sharp state senator and turn him into a senator and a president and put up the big money. I know the great myth is that Obama, you know, his campaign was fueled by people sending in 20 cents and 50 cents and things like that and from through the Internet. It's nice to have those myths, but for those who like their reality straight, it's corporations like Archer Daniels Midland and big bucks billionaires like Penny Pritzker, who was a predatory, who basically virtually created the subprime loan market. Now, understand what subprime loans are. It's loan sharking in home mortgages. There's no other way to put it. I got to tell you, my wife is a banker. She has never given out a subprime loan in her life. She says human beings are not subprime. They're people who have little money or more money. But when you give someone a subprime loan, what you're saying is, you don't deserve a loan. We'll give it to you anyway, as long as you pay loan shark interest rates. So instead of charging someone 5 and 6% for a mortgage, which is what an honest banker does with a conventional mortgage, no, you know, fixed rate, they charge them 9 and 10%, but they hide the extra percentage points so you don't see them in the first couple of years of payments. They add that to the total of the mortgage, and then they kick it up to 9, 10, 11%. You have people with mortgage rates with banks paying next to zero money from the Federal Reserve, 1/4 of 1%, they're lending it back out countrywide at 11%. in those mortgages, 12% in those mortgages. Penny Pritzker is one of the people that created that market. She also helped create something else called securitization, in which you take all these crappy mortgages. So what happens, they're not bad mortgages. Understand, people could pay their mortgages if they were normal rates, like 5 and 6%. But anyone who's ever dealt with a loan shark knows, okay, that, yeah, a normal loan is, people weren't irresponsible buying these homes. They could afford these things, but it's when those interest rates shot up, suddenly they can't afford it. Now, I know it's a radical Chavista idea to say we got to cap interest rates. And so that kind of left-wing commie Hillary Clinton suggested it because it was based, and by the way, there was one other candidate in the race that suggested freezing the interest rates, John McCain. You know, I know it's unpopular to say that. The only guy defending the banks actually was Obama during that campaign. No one wanted to hear that, but that's how it is. And again, you might have to go back. I can't, you know, I don't know what their private conversations were, but that's where Obama's getting his money from, these banks.
Well, I can tell you this, Greg. You know, the Flashpoint's investigation included going back to that home district and actually talking to people who were being ripped off while Obama was still a state senator, reaching out to him for help, and he seemed very helpful until it was understood that Penny Pritzker was at the heart of the matter. So here is a woman who purposely targeted people of color, as you say, poor people, working class people, with this kind of predatory operation. They went after people in West Virginia, coal miners, you know, ninth grade, eighth grade, seventh grade educations were bamboozled by the hundreds by the Pritzker operation, as you say, a mob.
And by the way, she was put out of business. I mean, it's like as if, it's one thing to say, for example, Obama just gave back money from this shark Stanford, who just ripped off $8 billion. He gave back the donations he received. But, you know, you could say, how did he know that this guy was running an $8 billion scam? Penny Pritzker was already nailed as a predatory lender, a shark victimizing the people in his home district on the south side of Chicago, and then he teamed up with her to run for president. Now, I got to tell you, you know, Pritzker, by the way, supports lots of liberal causes. And I suppose I'm going to lose some donations at CraigPalace.com if you're going after rich liberals. But, you know, you got to ask, in some cases, where are the rich liberals, how they got rich. And in Pritzker's case, it was pretty scary stuff. He knew she was a predatory lender when he hooked up. And what's worse, he did very little. And during the campaign, he resisted the calls to attack the bankers who are doing this stuff. And I want to go back to one other guy who was blowing the whistle on them, a guy named Elliot Spitzer, who attempted to stop these predatory loan practices, and they got him. Yes, you could say he you know, he got caught with his pants down, and he's the guy who unzipped them in the first place, and that's, you know, there's no excuses.
Former governor of New York, yes.
But yeah, the former governor of New York. But the truth is that he was going after these predatory lenders, and there's zero doubt that that's why they got him, is that he was the one guy saying people like Penny Pritzker's actions, Countrywide Financial's actions, are not just creepy and bad and destroying our country. They're illegal. They should be stopped. They're against the law.
I think the beauty about Penny Pritzker is that she had her subprime operation and securitization operation on steroids, starting going for about 8 to 10 years before everybody else caught on. So she did her thing. She crashed the Superior Bank for $2 billion in Chicago, and then got out, paid a little slap on the wrist fine, and then gave us the new president.
Yeah, well, you know, it is a problem because we have a president who has picked people straight out of the banking community, or who have or always been toys of the banking community, like little Timmy Geithner and Larry Summers, who are, of course, proteges of Robert Rubin of Citigroup. And you've got a big problem that these guys have a tough time telling banks no. The only bank that they ever went after was Lehman Brothers, and that was, by the way, the story there. I was wondering, why pick on Lehman? The answer is that Henry Paulson, when he was trying to take over control of Goldman Sachs, went after John Corzine, and Lehman Brothers tried to block him from taking control. They thought it was bad etiquette among investment bankers to attack each other. And so there was kind of a great personal animosity between Paulson and Fold of Lehman. So because of this like little internal squabble, they decide to do a public execution of one bank. Other than that, the banks have, you know, are otherwise being totally, totally covered. But I don't mind. I got to tell you, look, we live in a capitalist system. This is, you know, we are not in, you know, this is not the Bolivarian state of America.
Too bad.
And, well, you know, the, good or bad, we've got these banks and they've got us. And we probably have to bail them out. I know a lot of people on the left won't like to hear that. But we have no, at this moment, we've already made the bargain with the devil. You know, and so if we don't, you know, we go to hell, guys. This is what's happening. This is what's really happening. But the thing is, what do we get in return? This is what Roosevelt said to these guys. Roosevelt shut down all the banks. It was called a bank holiday, which is a pretty funny way of putting it. It wasn't a bank holiday. It was a bank seizure and shutdown of the entire financial system. And he said, the only banks that are going to open up are those that agree to the following terms. You know, you're going to, first of all, split the casino operations, the investment banks, from the piggy bank savings operations called commercial banks. And he created a wall called the Glass-Steagall Act. Clinton, Bill Clinton, ripped that apart. If Obama is serious, the first thing he will do, the guy, by the way, Obama himself said deregulation is the problem. It wasn't another thing that my friends on liberals on will not like to hear. It wasn't George Bush who deregulated the financial market. It was Bill Clinton. Okay, Bill Clinton deregulated the market. And Bush just took advantage of the deregulation, you know, let it roll on. But it was Clinton who did it.
And to be clear, Clinton sort of used the Reagan model of deregulating the SNLs and just expanded it to the entire financial industry.
We lost $500 billion on the SNLs. He said, so let's double down and see if we can now, since we deregulated SNLs and we practically blew apart the economy, let's see what happens if we deregulate the rest of the banks. And now we know. So if Obama's serious, the first thing, what I don't understand is the first thing he should do is, and Roosevelt did this literally within hours of taking office, shut down the banks, put them back in order, and said, here's the terms under which you will loan, and put limits on interest rates. You cannot, Hillary Clinton, John McCain, Franklin Roosevelt, now McCain, I have to say, probably had no idea what he was talking about. He's probably handed some index card. When he was asked about it, he didn't even know what he was talking about. But Hillary Clinton is very clear. An interest rate freeze. We have to remove these predatory explosion clauses in these mortgages. If someone is paying 6% already or 8% already too high, that's it. They don't kick up.
Remind people what those explosion clauses are, because, again, Penny was the master and the originator in those kinds of
things.
What
you do is you go in and you get a mortgage, and you're told, oh, you're a black person, you get what's called a subprime mortgage. And I'm not kidding about that. It's, Mr. Obama, 70% of black people who got mortgages were listed as subprime. It didn't matter if they earned $350,000 a year. They're all subprime. You're black, you're subprime. Okay. Then they say, okay, if you're subprime, you get a special type of loan. It looks good at first because it's 4, 5, 6% like normal. But in the fourth year, third or fourth year, it kicks up to, and doesn't say 11%. It just says some formula, okay? Well, the formula ends up being 11%. And you have to understand, when you have that type of adjustment, and sometimes it may actually begin in the second year, but you don't see it because they bury the extra interest by adding it to your total balance due. Okay, so it becomes part of your principal. It's a very brilliant, complex scam. But it is a scam. And as I've said, banking laws in every state were normally considered to prohibit this kind of hanky-panky. And, you know, I got to say, the only thing wrong with Penny Pritzker in getting shut down is that, again, she was an originator who pocketed untold amount by creating this monster. But her bad luck was also by being an originator. Is that they shut down her bank. Well, you can see they have no interest in shutting down Countrywide Financial, which they should do tomorrow morning, the biggest mortgage lender in America. When I say they are not one company, they were handling something like 40% of the mortgages in America in 2007. I mean, that's how big they were.
Well, the good thing, though, in terms of Penny Pritzker's luck is, according to the FBI, they're going to be investigating various aspects of this starting in 2003 or four. So she doesn't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, she's off the hook. Well, I should say, And Obama talked, during his campaign, talked about how the subprime mortgage market went bad. That's like saying loan sharking went bad. When was it good, Mr. Obama? So here's the thing. You know, what we have to remember is that we have to take action. And I, whether you believe that the banks should be bailed out or not, we can have that discussion forever. The real issue is, what do we get in return? And the only thing so far that I've really seen in demanded in return is, you know, this kind of soft, silly cap on bonuses, which isn't going to hold, and salaries. I mean, it's a more of a PR gimmick than anything else. But the main thing we want is stop destroying this nation. Stop throwing people out of their homes. By the way, I just spoke to Robert Pratt yesterday, who's losing his home. He wants to pay. I mean, in fact, what's crazy is every dime he gets, he keeps sending it to these people, which I think is a, you know, I don't want to give him advice, but financial advice, but frankly, I wouldn't, because they are going after, people who could really pay their mortgages if they weren't being ripped off. Why should we pay Countrywide Financial $1,000 to refinance Robert's loan and not even, you know, not stop this predatory hike in his interest rates? Why are we paying Bank of America when we've already given them $50 billion? We should say, okay, here's your $50 billion. But what you're going to do is, for $50 billion, you're not going to throw Robert Pratt's family out of their home in Detroit. And if you, and the thing is that there's already three houses foreclosed on that street. America isn't saved when we have a fourth family thrown out. The weeds grow up to the roof. Within 24 hours, there is not a fixture left in those foreclosed houses. They are ripped apart. Every bit of plumbing is taken by scavengers and vandals. It all goes. You know, that's what's happening to American neighborhood. We are being vandalized, but the real vandals are at Countrywide Financial and Bank of America. That's the real predators out there, and that is up to completely within Mr. Obama's power to stop. He does not have to, and I repeat this, President Obama does not have to in any way bargain with Republicans to get this done. Franklin Roosevelt didn't bargain with anyone to get this done. The comptroller of the currency, the Federal Reserve, all the banking regulators have complete power to get this accomplished. You notice that when Geithner put out $2 trillion to back up the banks, he didn't go back to Congress with that one. He just did it. He just made it available. I don't mind that. What I do mind is, what do we, the people, get in return? Believe me, when 9 million families lose their homes, everyone in America's home is devalued. It doesn't help us. When those people are thrown out of their homes and they have to live in shelters, that doesn't help America, okay? That doesn't help me out. What I need is for the president to use the power he has, like Franklin Roosevelt did, and pull the trigger on these guys and say, no more foreclosures. It's a moratorium. That's it. And we're not giving you $1,000 to not throw people out of their homes. We're giving you billions of dollars, and you're not throwing people out of their homes. When I read about that $1,000 bonus, that really, to me, that was the final straw. What the heck is that? To predatory lenders, you give $1,000? Forget it. And they're not even taking it. Because the other problem is, these guys are so greedy that they're not even going to take the $1,000. They're not going to take it.
Well, we're going to watch that story very closely. We have been speaking with Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. And by the way, I saw all those bankers call to Washington, D.C. to talk about what was happening with the money. They all came. They all talked very softly, but none of them talked about where the money that they already got is.
Right. There is no accounting for where the money is. In other words, the Federal Reserve, in a few cases, they said, well, you have to lend out the money. But remember, it's like squeezing on a balloon. If you tell a bank, okay, lend out the money we're giving you, but then they don't lend out other money. And we're also saying, gee, they should tighten up their loan standards. In Britain, Gordon Brown, the prime minister, said any bank that does not refinance current customers will be nationalized, period. In fact, not only do we not want you tightening standards, It's a recession. No one can live up to even normal standards. It is the point of a recession. The point, excuse me, recession is a sissy term. What's happening in this depression, and it is a depression, because anytime you head to 10% unemployment, which is clearly what's going on, you are in an official depression. Okay, we are in a depression. And what happens in a depression is that people don't have money to spend. They don't spend it. When they don't spend it, other people don't have money to spend, and they don't spend what they don't have. And it's a brutal, vicious cycle. It's what Marx called, you know, the crisis machine in capitalism. And what Keynes said is, you know, this system that eats and feeds on itself. And even the right-wing economist, Irving Fisher, said this is a continuing circle of disaster, which you have to pull out of. And you can't do it, Mr. Obama, by trying to bribe predatory bankers with $1,000. You can't do it.
All right, Greg Palast, we're going to leave it right there. Again, gregpalast.com. I want to let people know that if they want to see what we did in terms of Penny Pritzker, Pritzker, a current senior advisor to Obama, check out Obama's Subprime Problems. It's either on Consortium or Common Dreams. We want you to know what's going on here behind the scenes. Last word, Greg?
Yeah, one, and let me add this, Dennis. For those who are listening to Dennis Bernstein and Flashpoints, you have to read this story of Bernstein's investigation, the Flashpoints investigation of Penny Pritzker. That's, you will see exactly how the system works and see the ugly details of how this system is working. What we mean by that polite little term, subprime mortgages. We're talking about communities being eaten alive by greedy sharks. And it is a brilliant, brilliant investigation. And that's what you get on Flashpoints that you get nowhere else in the United States of America. I can tell you that right now. And you're not going to get it on MSNBC or you name it. It ain't going to be there. Either you got the right-wing fruitcakes or you have the left-wing Obama cheerleaders. What you're not getting is news. And you get that news on Flashpoints. That's an unsolicited commercial.
I was going to say the check's in the mail, Greg.
I'm serious. If people don't support this program, I'm hanging up.
All right. Well, we're going to have to hang up right now, but we, again, really enjoy having you with us. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints, Greg.
Thanks, Dennis.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein. And our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.